Welcome back to the deep dive. Okay, let's unpack this. Today, we're diving deep into someone we all think we know, the one and only Will Ferrell. Most of us, you know, we immediately picture Ron Burgundy, Buddy the Elf, Frank the Tank, these huge characters.
Absolutely. They're iconic.
But as we've been digging through the sources, articles, interviews, research, well, a much richer, more complex picture starts to come together.
Yeah, it really does.
We're aiming to go beyond the punchlines, really uncover the formative experiences, the strategic choices, even the surprising stuff that shaped him.
Into this incredibly versatile figure in entertainment and, like you said, even sports, which is wild.
Right.
And what's so fascinating here, I think, is connecting those dots. You know, everyone sees the comedic talent, the sheer volume of work. It's incredible.
Undeniable.
But the full journey, that often gets missed. We're talking like from a quiet childhood in Irvine, suburban kid,
right,
to being this prolific award-winning producer.
Yeah.
And all these diverse personal interests, like owning a soccer team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the LAFC thing. We'll get into that.
Exactly. So our mission, really, is to trace how those early things, that inherent drive, how they kept influencing everything he did later, give you, our listener, a kind of aha moment about him.
Yeah, think of this as your shortcut, basically. Understanding the guy behind the laughter, the current under the surface, we're going to pull out those surprising facts, the pivotal moments, you know, that really define him, give you a fresh perspective on why he's had such an enduring legacy.
You'll definitely see layers you maybe didn't expect.
So let's pull back that curtain. Let's explore the unseen depths of Will Ferrell. Okay, so to really get at what makes him tick, comedically, we got to start at the beginning, right?
Always the best place.
John William Ferrell, born July 16, 1967 in Irvine, California, heart of Orange County.
Yep.
His mom, Betty Kay, she was a teacher. His dad, Roy Lee Ferrell Jr., well, he's a musician, played sax and keyboards for the Righteous Brothers.
Wow, the actual Righteous Brothers. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. But interestingly, both parents were actually from Roanoke Rapids, North Carolina. They moved out to California in 64.
Ah, okay. So that classic California story, but with this, like, Southern heritage mixed in.
Exactly. English, German, Irish ancestry, too. Kind of a blend.
It's interesting, too, thinking about those really early experiences.
Yeah.
Things you have no control over.
Like what?
Well, not many people know this, but as an infant, he had something called pyloric stenosis.
Oh, what's that?
It's basically the opening between the stomach and the small intestine thickens up in babies, blocks food. He needed surgery, a pyloromyotomy, really early on.
Huh. Just a little detail, but it shows vulnerability, right? Way before the comedy armor went up.
Exactly. And then there was the home life stuff. His parents divorced when he was 8.
Right. He's always said it was amicable, though. Made the joke about, you know, 2 Christmases.
Yeah, the classic kid line. But the reality, his dad's income as a musician, it was unsteady, show business, right? Lots of travel, financial ups and downs. And that instability, it really stuck with young Will. Made him initially want a steady job, something outside of entertainment.
That's fascinating because you see that later, don't you? The move into producing, the business ventures. It's like he's building that stability himself.
Precisely. More control, more consistency than just acting gigs alone provide. It makes total sense given that early experience.
It is kind of ironic, though, that desire for stability coming from the son of a Righteous Brother musician.
Totally.
And then how it maybe pushed him towards comedy in a weird way. Oh. Because that environment in Irvine, he talks about it a lot. Safe, master-planned Irvine.
Yeah, almost too safe from his perspective.
Right. He said there was no drama, so we had to create it in our heads. His whole thing was just cracking his friends up, finding new ways to be funny.
It wasn't humor born from, like, tough circumstances or survival. It was humor born from boredom.
Exactly. Yeah. Breaking the monotony of suburbia, making fun of the everyday, twisting it. That feels like the seed of his whole style, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Finding the absurd in the ordinary and just committing 100%. That Irvine experience, you can see it echo through his whole career, even the wild stunts later on.
Yeah, that need to inject chaos.
And you see it developing through school too. Culverdale Elementary, Rancho San Joaquin Middle, University High in Irvine. He wasn't just the class clown though.
No, he was pretty well-rounded. Kicker on the football team.
Yep, soccer team, captain of the basketball team, student council.
And voted best personality. No surprise there.
Not at all. But those things matter, right? Leadership, teamwork, dealing with different kinds of people. Skills you definitely need as an actor and especially as a producer later on.
Oh, totally. You can see the direct line. He said third grade was pivotal.
Why third grade?
That's when he figured out he could make friends just by, like, pretending to smash his head against the wall or tripping on purpose.
That's so feral. Just pure physical commitment to get a reaction.
Yeah, a very direct way to connect. And it got more elaborate. High school senior year, he and a friend did comedy skits over the school intercom.
No way. With the principal's permission.
Apparently. They wrote their own stuff. Shows that creative spark was there early.
Definitely. Performing, writing.
Then he goes off to USC, University of Southern California, studies sports broadcasting initially.
Mm-hmm.
Makes sense, given the sports background.
And the later obsession with sports.
Right. Joined Delta Fraternity, got known for pranks, dressing as a janitor in friends' classes.
Oh, wait.
Streaking on campus, just fully committed to the bit, even then. That boundary-pushing energy was always there.
Yeah, but the path wasn't like a straight shot to start him after college. That's relatable, too.
Oh, totally. He gets his degree in sports information in 1990, but quickly realizes, nah, broadcasting, isn't it?
So the uncertainty phase.
Big time. Takes a job as a hotel valet. Second day. Rips a baggage rack clean off a van trying to drive under a low beam.
Oh, my God. Just careless.
Totally. Then he works as a teller at Wells Fargo. This is classic. Comes up short in his drawer, like $300 one day, $280 the next.
Wow. Not exactly employee of the month.
Not because he was stealing, just not suited for that structured thing.
Yeah.
It humanizes him, though, right? Future superstar, struggling with normal jobs.
Absolutely. Makes you realize even incredibly confident performers can flounder outside their element. It wasn't working.
And that's where his mom, Betty Kay, comes in. Gives him that crucial advice in 91, pursue something you actually like.
Good advice.
Leads him to L.A., and this is where things click. He auditions for The Groundlings.
The legendary improv group.
And gets in. He'd tried stand-up before, didn't really take, but improv. That was his sweet spot.
Makes sense. Less about polished routines, more about character reacting, that physical stuff he excelled at.
Totally. He loved the impersonations, started doing Harry Carey there.
Ah, the beginning of Harry Carey.
The Groundlings was his lab, basically, where he cooked up those characters.
Like the Batabi brothers, right, with Chris Kattan.
Exactly. Those two guys trying to pick up women at clubs became huge in the Groundlings scene, obviously led to the movie later.
And he needed flexibility back then. Didn't he have some side job?
Yeah, his friend who later became his wife, Viveka Pollan, got him a job at an auction house. It was perfect, gave him time for auditions, rehearsals.
Smart. It wasn't overnight success. It was a grind.
Totally. Small TV roles, Grace Under Fire, Living Single, commercials. He was even a Mall Santa one winter.
Mall Santa. That's amazing. Yeah. Shows the hustle, right? Doing whatever it took before the big break.
And all that grinding, all that creativity bubbling up at the Groundlings, it absolutely paid off. Led straight to the big one, Saturday Night Live.
The call up.
Yeah. But you got to remember, SNL was kind of in a slump then. Mid-90s, 94, 95. They needed fresh blood badly.
Right. The show goes through those cycles.
So a producer sees the Groundlings, spots Ferrell, Kattan, Sherry O'Terry, invites them to audition for Lorne Michaels.
And the rest is history.
Pretty much. Ferrell joins in 95, stays 7 years, leaves in 2002. And by 2001, he was crucial. Highest paid cast member, $350,000 for the season.
Wow. That speaks volumes about his impact on reviving the show.
Definitely.
Because he really was central to that resurgence. His consistency, the characters he created, they were just unforgettable.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't just fit in. He became like a pillar of the show during that era, helped bring it back to life.
People still talk about his run as one of the best ever.
Oh, absolutely. That Grantland poll in 2014 voted him the best SNL cast member of all time. Think about all the legends who've been on that stage. That's incredible.
It really is. He just had that knack for creating things that stuck, you know?
Yeah.
Became cultural shorthand.
And the impersonations were a huge part of that. He wasn't just mimicking. He was capturing an essence, then dialing it up to 11.
The George W. Bush one.
Yeah.
Iconic.
Totally. And it's interesting. He refused to meet Bush, right?
Yeah. Said it was for comedic purposes. Didn't want it to soften the impression and also his political standpoint. Just don't want to meet that guy.
Shows real integrity. Sticking to his guns for the comedy and his own beliefs.
Definitely. And beyond Bush, Harry Carey, obviously. Robert Goulet singing like Sisqo and Biggie.
That was brilliant. So absurd. But he pulled it off with that weird sincerity.
His range was nuts. Neil Diamond, James Lipton.
Who apparently loved Ferrell's take.
Yeah. Ted Kennedy, Janet Reno, even Ted Kaczynski.
Whoa, Kaczynski. That's dark, but I bet it was funny.
He did Al Gore, Saddam Hussein, Fidel Castro. It wasn't just mimicry, like you said. He found the comedy in them, blew it up, made them cultural touchstones.
He really distilled their essence and then just ran with it. Genius level stuff.
And then the original characters, just as legendary, if not more so.
Batabi Brothers, obviously, led to A Night at the Roxbury.
But the one everyone remembers.
Or Al Bell.
Gene Frankel, the Blue Oyster Cult cowbell player. That sketch is just peak SNL, pure commitment to absurdity.
Modeled on their singer, Eric Bloom, apparently. But yeah, that sketch is immortal, still quoted constantly.
And then there was Dale McGrew, the patriotic office worker.
Oh yeah, the half t-shirt, the really short shorts.
He improvised turning the shorts into a thong right before they went live.
Yes, you could see the other cast members breaking. Sean William Scott, the host, was losing it.
That's pure Ferrell pushing it, surprising everyone, even his own castmates. Total commitment to the bit, live on air.
Incredible. And there were others, too. Tom Wilkins from Morning Latte, Ned, the twin brother of Mr. Ed, Marty Culp, the music teacher, Craig Buchanan, the cheerleader.
And there's so many classics, often tapping into everyday stuff, anxieties, but making it hilarious.
Mm-hmm. And his return visits as host solidified his legacy, got him into the Five Timers Club.
Right. He kept coming back, often doing Alex Trebek in Celebrity Jeopardy.
Always great. And even while he was dominating SNL.
He was already dipping his toes into movies. Smart move.
Yeah, setting himself up for the next phase.
Yeah.
Thinking out that steady job, maybe.
Could be. He was Mustafa in Austin Powers back in 97.
Right, that was a big one. Got him seen by a huge audience.
Then in A Night at the Roxbury in 98, obviously, Superstar 99. And Mugatu in Zoolander in 2001.
Mugatu. So funny. Showed he could play that kind of villainous, eccentric character, too.
Definitely. These weren't just random roles. He was building connections, testing the waters, getting ready for that jump to full-time movie star, laying the groundwork.
And that groundwork paid off immediately. He leaves SNL in 2002, and boom, he's a leading man.
Old School in 2003 was the game changer, wasn't it? Frank the Tank.
Absolutely pivotal. The New York Times basically said the movie belonged to him, praised his hilarious, anxious zealotry.
That movie just launched him, put him right at the center of that whole, what do they call it, the frat pack?
Yeah, the frat pack. Him, Jack Black, Ben Stiller, Steve Carell, Vince Vaughn, Paul Rudd, the Wilson brothers, Owen and Luke.
That group defined comedy for a while there.
They really did. A whole wave of that kind of irreverent, often improvised, guy-centric comedy. And Ferrell was arguably the king of it.
And man, did he ever run. After Old School, Elf.
Yeah.
2003, instant holiday classic.
Showed that sweet, sincere side mixed with the physical comedy. Got another MTV Movie Award nom for that.
Then Anchorman in 2004. Maybe his most quotable movie ever.
Stay classy, San Diego. It's up there. Just pure, committed absurdity.
Talladega Nights in 2006. That was his biggest opening back then, right? $47 million.
Yep. Huge hit. Then Blades of Glory 07, Step Brothers 08.
Step Brothers. Okay, maybe that's his most quotable. Took a while to become a cult classic, though.
It did. Mixed reviews at first, but audiences loved it. Made $128 million. That chemistry with John C. Reilly was just magic.
So good. Riley's cockiness and Ferrell's like puppy dog thing.
Exactly. Then the other guys in 2010, his earning power back then was insane. $40 million in 2005 alone. Just a comedy juggernaut.
But what's really interesting is that during that same period, he wasn't just doing broad comedy. He stretched himself.
Right. The dramatic stuff.
Yeah.
Which surprised a lot of people. Stranger Than Fiction in 2006.
That was really good. Showed he could do nuanced, serious work. Got a Golden Globe nomination for it.
Yeah, playing the guy whose life is being narrated, it was poignant. Really challenged perceptions, showed real depth.
He did Everything Must Go Later, too, in 2010. And Downhill with Julia Louis-Dreyfus, more recently.
Critics took notice. The magazine named him one of their actors of the year in 2006. He wasn't content just being the funny guy.
His collaborations were key, too. Adam McKay, obviously. They wrote a lot of those hits together.
Yeah, Step Brothers, Talladega Nights, the other guys. That partnership was incredibly fruitful.
The other guys with Mark Wahlberg was great too. Unexpected pairing, but it worked. Made over $140 million. Good reviews.
Mm-hmm. And even recently showing up as the Mattel CEO in Barbie last year.
Right. A smaller role, but in this massive cultural phenomenon, shows he's still relevant, still fits into these big moments.
Absolutely. Keeps him connected to new audiences.
And we shouldn't forget his voice acting. That's a whole other side of his career.
True. He was Bob Oblong in The Oblongs way back.
Voiced Ted, the man in the yellow hat in Curious George.
Yeah, the gentle side. Then Megamind in 2010. He stepped in after Robert Downey Jr. and Ben Stiller were attached.
Yeah, and he was great. Played that villain-turned-hero thing really well.
and President Business in the Lego Movie.
Everything is awesome. He was hilarious in that. Did the sequel too.
And he's going to be in Despicable Me 4.
Yeah.
So he's still very active in animation.
Yeah.
Shows his range, right? Not just physical comedy, but vocal performance too.
Okay, so let's shift gears a bit. Beyond the acting, which is huge, obviously, he's also this innovator, this producer, this businessman almost.
Yeah, that side is really important to understanding the whole picture. Funny or Die, for instance, launched in 2007 with Adam McKay.
That was so ahead of its time. A streaming site for short comedy, user-generated stuff before YouTube was even that big.
Totally. Showed a real understanding of where digital media was going. Very entrepreneurial.
And it kicked off with The Landlord, right? Him and McKay's toddler daughter, Pearl.
Yes. Pearl is the swearing, beer-drinking landlord. It went massively viral.
Caused a bit of a stir, though, didn't it? Child psychologists weren't thrilled.
A little bit. McKay defended it, said she was just repeating things, didn't understand. They even did a follow-up, good cop, baby cop, joking about her retirement.
It was groundbreaking stuff for online comedy back then. Showed how celebrities could use that new space.
Definitely set a precedent. But Funny or Die was just one piece. His producing work is extensive and really successful. Award-winning successful.
Right. He clearly has that steady job drive working behind the scenes, too.
Mm-hmm. He and McKay exec produced Eastbound and Down for HBO.
Where he played Ashley Schaefer. You're something out.
Hilarious recurring role. He also produced The Chris Gethard Show. Dead to me.
But the big one, production-wise, has to be Succession.
Absolutely. A straight-up drama. And as an executive producer, he won 4 primetime Emmys for that show.
4 Emmys? That's huge. Shows his taste isn't just limited to comedy. He knows good storytelling.
Definitely. And he got more Emmys for the live in front of a studio audience specials, too. He's a genuine powerhouse producer. Understands the whole process.
But that partnership with McKay, which was so successful, it ended pretty dramatically, didn't it?
Yeah, in 2019. They split personally and professionally. Closed down Gary Sanchez Productions.
And the reason was about casting, right? The Jerry Buss role in Winning Time.
Exactly. McKay cast John C. Reilly, a role Ferrell really wanted, apparently without telling Ferrell first.
Ooh, that's tough. Shows how complicated those long-term creative partnerships can be. Trust and communication are everything.
It really highlights the human element, even in big Hollywood deals. Personal feelings, perceived slights, they matter.
So beyond producing, he also hit Broadway.
He did. Made his debut in 2009. A one-man show, You're Welcome, America, A Final Night with George W. Bush.
Timed perfectly, right? Started performing the day Bush left office.
Brilliant timing. Satirical genius. It got great reviews, earned him a Tony nomination for Best Special Theatrical Event.
Wow, commanding a Broadway stage solo. That's another level.
And he keeps finding new platforms, like podcasting.
The Ron Burgundy Podcast, launched in 2019, bringing that character back in a totally different format.
And it worked. Super successful, still going. Shows Burgundy's appeal isn't just visual.
It really demonstrates how he leverages those iconic characters smartly.
And that led to him launching his own podcast network, Big Money Players Network, with iHeartRadio later that same year.
A podcast mogul now, planning like 10 comedy podcasts.
Yep, always innovating, always looking for the next platform, never standing still.
His recent movie choices show that too, still mixing it up.
Eurovision Song Contest in 2020, that felt like a real passion project.
Oh yeah, combining the comedy and music, then Spirited with Ryan Reynolds, the Christmas musical.
And Will and Harper, the documentary from this year, taking that road trip with his friend Harper Steele after she came out as trans.
That feels really different, personal, vulnerable.
Exactly. Shows a willingness to engage with important, socially relevant stories. Shows growth, I think.
Of course, not everything works. Land of the Lost back in 2009 was a big flop.
Yeah. Happens to everyone. And that Russ and Roger Go Beyond movie got canceled because of the hashtag MeToo stuff around Russ Meyer. Shows how external factors can derail things, too. It's a long career. There are always ups and downs.
Okay, so we've covered the career path, the evolution. Let's look a bit more at Will Ferrell, the person, off screen.
The man behind the elf suit.
He married Viveka Paulin, Swedish actress, back in August 2000. They met in an acting class in 95.
Nice. Full circle.
Yeah. They have 3 sons, born 04, 06, 10, live in New York and Orange County, keeping those California roots.
Mm-hmm. And he's pretty active physically, right? Runs marathons.
Yeah. Boston, New York, Stockholm. That takes discipline. And he does significant charity work, too, like the Scholarships for Cancer Survivors campaign.
Using his platform for good. Seems genuinely committed to that.
His public persona is interesting, too. Remember that time Autograph Magazine called him the worst celebrity autographer?
Huh. Yeah, what was that about? Was he just rude?
Not exactly. He admitted he likes to taunt them playfully. Ask stuff like, "How badly do you want this? Prove you're my biggest fan. Makes them earn it."
That sounds exactly like him. Injecting that awkward, performative thing into a totally normal interaction, creating drama out of boredom again.
Totally. And politically, he's pretty clear where he stands. Supports the Democrats, campaign for Stacey Abrams in Georgia.
And we mentioned he wouldn't meet Bush, but he did meet the Obamas. Endorsed Eric Garcetti for LA mayor.
Yeah, so he's engaged civically. And again, we're just laying out the facts here, not taking sides on the politics itself.
Right. Standard disclaimer.
But the thing that seems to combine his personality, his love of performance, and just pure fun is
Oh,
sports.
the sports stuff is fantastic. It's way beyond just being a fan.
Remember the Billy Ray Rojo Johnson stunt? 2010 minor league baseball
A
game.
Venezuelan pitcher.
Yeah.
With a fake mustache that fell off and the bag of beer.
Yes! Throws one pitch, starts a fake fight, gets ejected, all for charity. Pure feral genius, turning a baseball game into performance art.
And that was just the warm-up. The 2015 MLB spring training day. That was epic.
Playing for 10 different teams in one day.
10 teams, 5 games, played all 9 positions, including DH, Dodgers, Giants, Angels.
And didn't he actually get someone out pitching?
Pitch for the Dodgers, face one batter, got him out. Career ERA.
That's incredible.
Even fouled off a 92-mile-per-hour fastball. All for Funny or Die. Raising money for cancer charities. The commitment is just unreal. Blending comedy, celebrity, passion, and charity perfectly.
His love for the LA Kings, the hockey team, is pretty intense too.
Oh, yeah. He's always there, front row, does funny videos for their Jumbotron.
The checkered face paint during the playoffs last year, that went viral.
Totally. Became a whole meme. And then he commentated a period of a Kings game as Ron Burgundy.
In character for a whole period.
Yep. Live on TV, just fully embracing the absurdity, merging his passions.
Amazing. And then there's the soccer ownership, LAFC.
Right. Part owner since 2016, along with Mia Hamm, Magic Johnson.
Why soccer?
He talked about loving how global it is, so many amazing players, top-flight leagues. Said he hopes MLS can eventually be on par with Europe. Seems like a genuine passion.
And it paid off. They won the MLS Cup in 2022. So Will Ferrell is an MLS champion owner.
Added to the list, it's such a unique achievement.
Speaking of achievements, the awards and honors go beyond just acting stuff, too.
Yeah, besides the Emmys for producing, the Golden Globe nom, the Tony nom, he got the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor in 2011.
That's a huge deal for a comedian, the Kennedy Center honor.
Massive. Honored by everyone, Conan, Riley, Stiller, Jack Black, Rudd, McKay.
Got a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame in 2015, an honorary doctorate from USC.
And that MLS Cup. It just shows the breadth of his impact, way beyond just making people laugh in movies. He succeeded in so many different fields. Hashtag JAG tag outro.
Wow. We've really covered a lot of ground, journeyed through the unseen depths, like we said, from that kid creating humor in Irvine to this like multi-hyphenate force in entertainment, sports, business. What really stands out for me anyway is just his commitment to whatever he's doing.
Absolutely, whether it's a character, a stunt, owning a team, he goes all in.
That authenticity shines through, doesn't it?
It really does. And connecting it back, his whole career feels like proof of the power of just embracing your own weirdness, your own unique voice, and just committing.
Yeah.
That ability to dive in, whether it's silly or serious or physically demanding it, resonates because you feel it's genuinely him. It makes you wonder how much of all that success comes back to that kid in Irvine just trying to break the boredom.
That's a great question. That fundamental impulse to inject drama, to commit fully, maybe that's the engine behind it all.
Could be.
So, for you listening, think about Will Ferrell's journey, Irvine to LAFC owner. Ask yourself, what seemingly random things in your own life, your own interests, might actually be connected by some deeper passion, something just waiting for you to commit to it fully and unapologetically?
You might be surprised where those connections lead.
A great thought to end on. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.
It was fascinating.
See you next time.